Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, I'm joined by Stefan Spida, my wonderful co-host, and our fantastic guest, Irene Moe, this week. We're going to talk about AT&T getting aggressive with infringers, Ron Wyden getting aggressive with bad data management, what the heck is up with the Jim Acosta video, and is defamation law ready for liability on retweets or even likes? All this and more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Stefan Spida, and Matt Curtis. Episode 442, recorded November 9th, 2018. Are you feeling lucky, punk? Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. Great to be here. Introduce you to my friend Clint Eastwood, who's going to be glaring over my shoulder the entire show. I'm borrowing a friend's office this week. So I think he will definitely be giving his opinions on the stories that we discussed today. And I think they're all sort of grim. anyway, we are nothing but grim with our panel today. I've got two wonderful folks with me. My co-host, Stefan Spida, is here. Hello, Stefan. Great to see you.
Hello, Denise. Great to see you, too. And Mr. Mayor from Carmel or whatever his nickname is as well.
Exactly. The mayor on my shoulder. Stefan is a lawyer at Dorsey & Whitney in Seattle, Washington, and litigates and practices law in the areas much like we discuss right here on This Week in Law. And we are thrilled to have with us a wonderful guest this week, Irene Moe, who was recently a fellow with the ABA Center for Innovation. She's now an attorney based in the Bay Area, and her emphasis is privacy and data security. And it's wonderful to have you on the show, Irene.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I look forward to joining the rest of the show.
Irene, before we jump into the stories in our rundown here, tell us a bit about your fellowship with the ABA Center for Innovation and what you worked on there.
Sure. So I spent the last year in Chicago at ABA headquarters working on trying to help low-income and marginalized individuals understand their privacy and data security risks. And the way that I was able to accomplish this was working with a privacy checkup tool, sort of like a health checkup tool, and integrating it into statewide legal resources websites.
And did you find that low-income, marginalized members of the population have a higher risk of any kind of vulnerability to security and data privacy issues?
Yeah, I think just like every other legal issue, this community is at a disproportionate risk. In this case, a lot of low-income communities are using Android phones, and that's their only point of access to the internet. And when you're using online resources to apply for benefits or do a lot of your online financial transactions, there's a lot of risk involved in that. And a lot of times this community is either unaware of the risk, or if they are aware, they don't know the resources to go to be able to educate themselves and take control of their online data.
Right. So it's great that you were doing that work. We've talked on the show before about, we talk a lot about data ownership and how economic models for managing data. And one of the things that comes up a lot is this sort of tiered idea where if you have the means, perhaps you can pay for a greater level of security and privacy in your service itself. I mean, certainly you can do it with, as you say, whatever hardware or systems you're using. But I'm just wondering if you looked at any business models like that and had any thoughts along those lines.
So I think currently in the United States, privacy is definitely a luxury good where if you can afford it, you have it. And a lot of times there are a lot of public benefits that come with trading in your privacy. So what was interesting to me was looking at the amount of resources that are out there and how they're worded and targeted towards primarily, you know, middle income Americans. And a lot of times there's a level of technical competency that comes with being able to use these resources and take ownership of your data. So looking at them and sort of not reinventing the wheel, but continuing to improve upon them so that the access to these resources are available to lower income individuals was really important part of my fellowship year.
Great. Well, I think we're going to have the opportunity to circle back to what you worked on during your fellowship kind of throughout the show today. But right now we're going to start out talking about some entertainment and copyright related issues. So one thing that caught my eye this week is we were following along for several years with the copyright alert system, which seems to have gone defunct. This was something that was going to apply to ISPs, and they adopted this policy for some time. You may remember it as the three strikes, or sometimes it was six strikes, or sometimes it was several more strikes than six system, where an ISP would slowly get more aggressive with a user that someone had reported for excessive infringement or sharing of copyrighted materials, and that ultimately the penalty was you could get kicked off the service. Well, the copyright alert system sort of went by the wayside. It didn't wind up having traction that kept it going very long. So the ISPs had to decide what they were going to do in lieu of that. And while all that was going on, one of the ISPs, AT&T, you know, it has gotten absolutely massive with DirecTV and also now Time Warner, which is a huge content company in its own right. One thing that it seems to have done is get a little more aggressive with how it's going to treat its users that it thinks are severe violators of our copyright laws. So Axios got a hold of some information from a source that told them that AT&T was going to alert more than a dozen customers within a week or so that they were going to get kicked off of their ISP because of their copyright infringing activity. So the Axios piece itself is interesting and provides more detail. It starts with a why it matters question, bullet point, and it points out much of what I just said, that it's shaping its own policies. What it doesn't point out in why it matters, and one of the reasons I think it matters, is because these people are losing their internet access, you know, because of a policy decision by the ISP and without really an evidentiary process or due process. And I don't, you know, you can argue about whether that is justified or warranted in this situation. ISPs can do business with their private entities and they can do business with whom they like. But I always think it's interesting, you know, coming back to how integral having online access is to people's lives and their services and their access to things that we just take as, for granted as necessary points of existence in our society, that for an ISP to be able to just toss people off willy-nilly might be something that law and policymakers get involved in. So we seem to be seeing AT&T getting a little bit more aggressive here. Wouldn't be surprised to see the other ISPs go this route in the absence of the copyright alert system as they formulate their own policies too, and as more and more of them have media sides of their business as well. Stefan, do you have thoughts on this?
Yeah, I understand the story at this point is just a scoop and we don't have all the details yet, but the basic outlines are the sort of thing that I think make a lot of people concerned about where copyright law is heading and how access to the internet is enforced. There are some corners that would like to see ISPs be treated like utilities and sort of find ways of treating access to the internet as sort of a right as opposed to a consumer transaction, something you purchase. And you can kind of see why as the importance of online access increases and our reliance on it becomes more entrenched. This sort of action starts to sound a lot more like depriving somebody of a due process right than it does like depriving somebody of a consumer good. And I think without knowing the facts, without knowing all the details, it's hard to speculate about exactly what happened and whether this is quote unquote fair or not. But I think it does offer an early look at where we might be heading in terms of interfering with people's ability to get online and what the parameters around that will look like. And it's an opportunity for those of us who don't believe that that access should be arbitrarily limited by private companies to speak up and try to come up with a framework to assist in navigating what is going to be an increasingly thorny issue.
Right. I mean, obviously, there's a point at which somebody is or can be misusing the service and they've violated the terms of service in such a way that I think reasonable minds would not disagree that, you know, they can go try and find another ISP if that's what they, you know, choose to try and do. But I think there's a lot of room for gray area there. And it would be nice to have more transparency about what you were saying, Stefan, how someone, the nice thing about the copyright alert system is it provided at least a little bit of a structure. So if you knew what the process was, you would know what sort of activity would trigger what sort of notices and then ultimately possibly termination of service. It seems a lot more opaque now that the ISPs are left to their own devices.
An analogy that we could consider is some states make it very easy to have your license suspended for various infractions and then you can't drive. And if you drive with a suspended license, then you get these cascading tickets that increasingly, you know, you can end up in jail. And, you know, Ohio is one of those states, and something like 10% of the state has these suspended licenses for various minor infractions. And it doesn't sound like a big deal until you think about the fact that it's impossible to get anywhere without your car. And so this relatively minor punishment that, you know, you could fix if you have $500 to pay or whatever it is, it goes away and you're done, you can move on, ends up impacting low-income people a lot more than it does people who have the means to pay. And you can see a similar issue with ISPs. If you live in an area where you don't really have alternatives to whoever has blocked your access to the internet, you're going to be disproportionately harmed by this framework. And so I think that's one of the reasons why having an equitable framework for access to the internet is going to be increasingly important, and finding ways to make sure that you don't have disproportionate punishments for people who can't afford alternatives will become an important issue.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And of course, you know, if you lost your license and had to find alternate modes of transportation, maybe you'd have public transportation that would be available and affordable, and maybe not, depending on where you live. And oh, great. Maybe you'd be able to Uber yourself around. But then again, that assumes a degree of resources that everyone might not have. Sorry, we dropped you there for a bit, Irene. I'm not sure how much of the discussion you caught, but we're talking about standards and transparency around ISPs deciding to terminate customers over their infringing or allegedly infringing activity. And just wondered if you had any thoughts about that.
Yeah, I was there up until it was time for me to talk. But I think all of us really focused on the due process of what AT&T is doing and sort of the lack of transparency of being able to ask, you know, what kind of evidence they have against you, how they came to this conclusion. And I try to look at AT&T's actual piracy policy, but I couldn't find it anywhere. And what I thought was interesting was that AT&T ended up approaching a lot of these news articles that were published and sort of clarified that, you know, their privacy policy has been in place for years. They're only punishing severe abusers of this, and that, you know, this sort of has nothing to do with their merger with Time Warner. It's more of an education tool than a punishment. But there's definitely a lot of gray area that I think needs to be explored, especially when, you know, as you guys have mentioned, that, you know, the internet is sort of a utility that a lot of people can't live without these days.
Yeah, so it seems like AT&T is perhaps going, saying, even though the copyright alert system has gone away, we thought that was a good system, and we're trying to adhere to its tenets, which were a lot about education. Again, that's why it was six strikes or nine strikes or whatever it wound up being. And all of those various intervals along the way were designed to tell you, hey, what you're doing there, it's illegal and a bad thing and could lose you your internet service. I guess one could question how much education people really need to have about that. I'm sure there are people who think that, hey, because I can do this with my computer and it's so easy to do, that perhaps it's perfectly legal. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to do it. So I think the education component is important. But there are probably a good number of people who are in the sights of ISPs for this kind of activity who are very well educated and know that no number of notices is going to dissuade them unless, you know, they decide, hey, I better knock it off or I'm going to lose my service. All right. Another interesting copyright infringement related story that caught my eye this week had to do with the UK and the economics of copyright trolling in the UK, where maybe some big rights holder goes after lots of small infringements and ask them, infringers, and ask them to pay, you know, hefty settlements for an individual, but small settlements in larger economic terms. But when you add them all together, it's quite a business model. This is something that, you know, we saw the entertainment industry in the United States pursue for some time and then abandon. Apparently, it's still going strong in the UK, or strong enough. There's also something that comes into play here that I think gives rise to this interesting development, and that is who bears the costs of this kind of litigation. If you're in a system where it's easy to be a plaintiff, you can file a lawsuit and scare someone on the other side and get them to settle rather than spend a lot of money to defend and perhaps lose based on the way that copyright law works both here and in the UK. That's one thing. But if you have a chance as the plaintiff of being wrong and having to pay the other side's attorney's fees, that's a pretty big deterrent. Well, one thing that has sprung up in the UK is the ability for someone who wants to go into the business of copyright trolling to buy some insurance against that, that will step in, and I guess it would have to assess the merits of each particular case that it's deciding to insure. And then, assuming that it decides the plaintiff has a really strong case and is likely to win, it will provide that degree of security and hedge against the risk that, oh, we could lose and then be on the hook for the other side's attorney's fees. So, you know, artifact of the world that we live in today, potential plaintiff's insurance against losing their copyright trolling case. What do you think of this, Stefan?
Insurance providers are pretty creative, I find, and mm-hmm. this is a good showing of that. This, you know, it's hard to unravel for me where the right policy solution is on some of this stuff. I think the idea of having large pools of money dedicated to insulating large companies from liability for launching suits and enforcement of their copyrights should scare anybody who uses the internet. I don't know that this is going to put the equities in the right place. I think the British system exists, you know, the sort of, I guess it's the whatever the fee shifting that, that exists in Britain exists for a reason. And this seems to be kind of an attempt to work around that in a way that subverts the policy to some degree. And I just, it makes me a little uncomfortable to think about where this is heading. But I don't know enough about the details to really say one way or the other if I think it's a good thing or a bad thing. It just on its face, to me, seems like a way of increasing the likelihood that innocent infringers are going to be getting demand letters that are going to be harder to swat away for activity that they may not have known was causing any problems, and is going to be done in a way that undermines the policy behind the fee shifting that exists in Britain. So on its face, it strikes me as a way for powerful people to gather more power, and that's not always a good thing.
Right. I think that's a really interesting point you bring up, that we have different systems. Oh, look, now I'm wearing Clint's hat. That's very nice if you're watching the video. Okay, distracted by the hat. There are different instances under United States law, whether contractually or by statute, where the British system comes to apply here. In other words, our default system is not that you're on the hook for the other side's attorney's fees, but it can be in certain instances. If you've agreed to that in your transactions with another party, or if a statute in a particular area says, yeah, we want to make sure that if you're going to bring a lawsuit in this area, you better be very solid on your facts and evidence, and know that if the other side loses or the other side wins, you're going to be on the hook for their fees. So I think it's really interesting, Stefan, what you just brought up, that perhaps even in the United States, you could see a business model arise where in all of those instances where fees might be a risk, perhaps there might be an insurance option available. And it does sort of upend what the system is designed to do, particularly in the UK, where they've decided that all lawsuits should have that higher degree of thought before you file them. What do you think about this, Irene?
I think it's interesting to focus on sort of their strategy that most people are going to settle, and to try and see what happens when perhaps a more knowledgeable defendant decides, you know, I have the time and I have the money and I'm going to try to fight this, you know, regardless of not the company actually has a lot of evidence against them or whatnot, but to see, you know, how far the companies can be pushed when defendants are willing to fight back, or, you know, if this will lead to an increase in these companies just churning and burning these cases out because they know that a majority of defendants don't have the time or money to hire a defense lawyer and will settle for a fraction of what they could possibly owe in statutory damages.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we got an interesting question in chat from Kara Te Coyote. Oh, Karate Type Coyote, which is just a great nick in chat. And I think it was prompted by our AT&T discussion earlier, and the question has to do with the walkouts that we saw at Google and the demands by the various Google employees who walked out that they'd like to see their company doing better in certain areas. And Karate Coyote is asking why we think we don't see that more often in other tech companies like Amazon, Facebook, Apple, et cetera. I mean, I think the obvious answer is people are worried about their jobs. These are not necessarily unionized positions. Maybe folks are not that comfortable with making that kind of statement. Of course, when they do it en masse, you know, it really has an impact like it did in the Google instance. At least it gets a lot of attention. It puts a lot of pressure on the company. So I'm going with fear as my speculative response to that question. What do you think, Irene?
I definitely think that fear and like the power dynamics has a great impact on employees' hesitancy to speak out. I also think that until very recently, and I mean within the last couple of years, you know, having internet as a utility or, you know, privacy as a right hasn't really been like a public interest issue. It's more been within public companies. And I don't think that consumers have really learned to use their voices powerfully as it has been for instance, like the Me Too movement or other things that have been brewing, you know, over the last decade. So I think that definitely as consumers are more educated about this and they're more willing to speak out, employees will feel more empowered to be able to do so based on consumer feedback.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. What do you think, Stefan?
Fear probably nails it. I think, you know, as you pointed out, these aren't exactly unionized jobs. Part of it, mm-hmm. too, is I think there's a resistance among a lot of tech workers to the idea that there's something systemically wrong with the process that got them where they are. I've spoken to a lot of engineers, when I live down in the Bay Area and up here as well, and they seem much more likely to believe that meritocracy is a thing than other people. I mean, and I'm maybe grossly generalizing here, but I've spoken with a lot of lawyers who sort of seem to understand that some combination of luck and winning the birth lottery got them where they are, and there's a sort of self-awareness around that. I found when speaking with engineers, there's kind of this, I don't want to say it's a lack of self-awareness, but there's sort of this more higher likelihood to believe that they got where they are because they're smarter and they worked harder. And so maybe they don't interrogate that process nearly as much as maybe some other people do. So maybe they just don't believe there's a problem. And so that's why they're not walking out. So those who would like to are afraid, and many probably just don't think there's an issue.
Right. And I think that building on that, I think there's a component too of faith in these companies that people went, you know, let's use Google as an example, that people who go to work at Google have drunk the Google Kool-Aid a lot and have, you know, worked hard to get into that competitive working environment and that they, you know, part of them wants to believe that that company does not do evil as it's motto used to be, and that you know that there's merit to that, and that they can believe in it, and that you know, I think maybe some of that can overcome people's impressions that gee, I heard that the company's doing this. Well, there must be some good reason for it. You know, I mean, I think maybe that otherwise their impulse to take a stand and be more vocal. And obviously at Google, you saw that people did take a stand and were vocal. But, you know, maybe the reason it didn't happen until now is that, as you point out, Silicon Valley has its own sort of bubble, Stefan. And part of being in that bubble is, you know, we're doing good stuff here. That's why we're here. and maybe it's hard for people to come to grips with the fact that, it's hard that maybe not everything that gets done by these companies is for societal good, ultimately. All right, let's go on to something much more lighthearted that probably should have been in our Halloween show recently, but didn't make it, didn't have room for that to happen. But worth discussing now, just because it's entertaining and probably something that a lot of Hollywood showrunners or set designers don't think too much about when they're putting things together. There is a lawsuit pending actually, I'm not sure if the lawsuit is pending. Maybe there's just legal saber rattling going on by, is it called the Satanic Temple? Yes, the Satanic Temple. Its co-founder, Lucian Greaves, is much aggrieved and raising hell about the fact that the Netflix show Sabrina, The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, which I obviously haven't seen yet. It debuted right around Halloween. And sounds like probably a good entertaining watch. But in the middle, apparently, of the school of witchcraft in this show is this statue monument of Baphomet, which you may have seen pictures before as the monument erected and associated with the Satanic Temple, which is an original work that they commissioned. And it's very associated with the Satanic Temple. So they're not happy with the fact that it's just plunked into the middle of what looks to be sort of an entertaining and lighthearted Netflix show, as particularly without any licensing or authorization. So it sounds like they certainly have a basis to legal saber rattle and perhaps go beyond that. It also sounds like, as I mentioned before, the set designers probably didn't think too much about this before just plunking it into the middle of, and it's quite a dominating feature in their set. What do you think about this, Stefan?
So I love this story for a couple of reasons. One, so first of all, actually, the lawsuit has been filed that appears to be pending in Southern District of New York. Cool. It's a funny act pattern, obviously, because it, nobody really, I think, for the most part, takes Satanists too seriously, but then they go ahead and file this lawsuit. So love it because it's funny. But also, we've talked a few times on the show, I think, about that graffiti case that I'd been following. And this type of fact pattern where somebody uses a sculpture in a movie could result in more of these lawsuits as a result of that graffiti case that we talked about, because how often do you see a movie where there's a brick wall and some graffiti in the background, nobody thinks anything about it? That could now result in a pretty thorny lawsuit based on the holding in Faulkner versus GM. And this is a little different because that sculpture isn't actually attached to a building, but it's the same underlying problem. And you could look at it and laugh, and we laugh because it's Satanists, but the actual underlying legal question here, I think, should set off some alarm bells for how many possible copyright troll cases we could have growing out of these types of mixed media performances where something gets filmed without the consent of whoever created the underlying work. And so it's actually probably going to be an interesting case, assuming they devote enough resources to it. And from what I understand, this particular group has a history of filing somewhat trivial sounding lawsuits in order to make a point, and they could very well keep going with this one, and I think it'll be an interesting one to follow, both again because it's funny and because the issue it raises is a little bit complex.
Right. Do you think it makes a difference that this was privately commissioned and then I'm sure it's publicly displayed somewhere? I don't know really all the history and background on the Baphomet statue, but it seems like it's something it's probably either in the temple or outside the temple, but associated with the temple. Do you think it makes a difference where the thing is displayed, whether it's for public or private consumption, or the fact that it was a privately commissioned work of art makes it something that you could recover if someone copies it and puts it in their show?
I don't know enough about the facts in the background here. I'd have to read the complaint to get a good sense of it. I do recall reading somewhere that one of the things they're concerned about is, although they're Satanists, they don't think of themselves, or at least publicly, they don't portray themselves as somehow evil. And mm-hmm. The way that this was used in the show suggested that there's something wrong with being a Satanist. And so I believe that there's sort of a religious liberty angle to this. We don't want to be associated with this discriminatory portrayal of our belief system, which puts Satan in the center of their system of belief. Now, query whether it's sincere or not, or if this is just an elaborate stunt. But if you think about just the question they're raising about taking someone's iconography, putting it in a in a light that is unflattering to them, and in the process violating their copyright, you could see how that very quickly snowballs into a real legal question, even though it started off as a kind of a joke. And you know, not to make any kind of offensive analogies here, but the European Court of Human Rights recently had a ruling on depictions of Muhammad that I think implicates similar questions, and everybody takes it seriously under those circumstances. And I think, despite the fact that this is a very funny way to enter the discussion, I think it's a serious issue that just underscores, for me anyway, just how easy it is to inadvertently find yourself in this legal mess whenever copyright comes up.
Right, and the fact that it's being portrayed, I think the main character in this Netflix series squares off against someone called the Dark Lord, who is somehow associated with the Baphomet statue. Maybe that there's some sort of libel or defamation claim that could be asserted because of that. And also it's not hard to see how speech considerations would then come in, because if they are, you know, somehow using the statue to critique the Satanists in some way, again, it would be a private actor speaking out, having some sort of critical commentary about the church in that instance. So I don't know if the First Amendment would necessarily ride to their rescue. But it's just interesting to consider the collision of copyright and speech in that kind of a situation as well. Irene, anything to add?
Yeah, so I think Satanists are actually from the Church of Satan, which is not the same as the Satanic Temple. And the only reason why I know this is because they have like a pretty large following and chapter from my home state, Michigan. and what's interesting about this case is that they are more focused on actually trying to have their statue move away from this like evil connotation. And they're asking for, you know, a retraction of the image from this series versus, you know, working out licensing terms. Like they don't want this statue to be, you know, any way associated with, I quote, asinine satanic panic fiction. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what kind of deal or settlement, you know, they work out to, or if the case moves forward, you know, what kind of solution ends up coming to it, because they're really focused on the underlying message that this statute shouldn't be focused with evil or bad characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's sort of interesting in that context to think about the fact that, well, if your real goal is to, you know, preserve your good name, then... then perhaps copyright isn't the right vehicle, but it seems to be an available one here, and they're going ahead and using it. All right. Any other thoughts, Stefan, before we move on?
Just, you know, hail Satan.
Indeed. All right. Well, let's move on and look at the devilish diminishment in our privacy protections. Just a bit of other shoe dropping. After the enactment of the GDPR last May, we've been interested to see how companies would react to the fact that you have to give anyone who is a EU resident various protections, including the right to access and download and ask for the deletion of their data. And in response to that, Apple has gone ahead and said that the online tool that it developed to comply with the GDPR, that's going to be available for all of its users in the United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. They can now see and download all information that Apple has collected on them. It also gives them easier ways to manage. And this is something that I found real interesting in the coverage on this, to make changes to the data. I'm just trying to think about a scenario where you would decide to look at all the data that Apple had on you. You see something that's a mistake and you decide to correct it. I'm just not sure why that would be relevant in this particular instance. I'm sure that the GDPR doesn't care that we're talking about a particular company, but it just, we're going to talk about altering video and deep fakes later. And I'm just, this ability to alter your data seems to be a little, I don't know, it just raises a little red flag in my mind. I could certainly see wanting to access it and maybe wanting to delete it. But if you're going to sort of change history, that seems to be, I don't know, at least worth discussion. Anyway, the tool is now available, not just to EU residents, but to folks in all those other countries as well. Irene, any thoughts?
I think that this is another example of how the exercise of becoming GDPR compliant, even though it was crazy, even though a ton of people hated going through it, it really helped companies sort of look at all the different places within them that were collecting information and then put it under, you know, one place. And I think Apple has done just that and has decided to sort of make this PR announcement about it to become more transparent. And I think that recently becoming transparent about consumer data that you're collecting has been sort of incorporated in a lot of companies' business models because it helps create trust with consumers. And, you know, the more a consumer trusts your company, ironically, the more information they want to give you. And I just think it's very interesting that, you know, all these sort of outside implications that GDPR has had on companies, especially, you know, in the US.
Absolutely. I think this is one of those instances where your work with your fellowship may come into play. Do you see the ability to access this kind of data about yourself having disparate impacts to disparate folks in the population, obviously based on where you live, but also how you live?
I definitely think that's true. Apple being sort of one of the main providers of smartphones, the ability for, you know, smartphone users, specifically Apple users, to access this definitely has a disproportionate effect for, you know, the low-income community who majority have Android products. And when, you know, one set of consumers can see what a company is collecting on them and then the others are left in the dark, that is where disparate effects happen. And, you know, sort of, again, the asymmetric power of one set of consumers being able to control their information and what is collected and even make changes to it, and another side being left in the dark and not knowing, you know, the amount of data or even what is being collected about them.
Right. And I think both you and Beatmaster are clarifying what I was kind of noodling about when you could possibly make changes to data that someone has collected about you. Beatmaster in IRC is asking about, isn't this parallel to companies that have financial information on you? And I think that you're probably right, Beatmaster, and that in that kind of instance, you would have the ability to demonstrate that the data about them was, or about yourself, was inaccurate, and you could correct it and make sure that you were both on the same page. But I think you would have some sort of affirmative showing you'd have to make to say, hey, you know, what you've got here is not correct. What I was thinking about is more the instance of Apple now tracking what my screen time is and my wanting to go in and change that and say, no, I didn't spend 18 hours on the phone last week. I only spent 2 when that wasn't actually the case or, you know, demonstrable. What do you think, Stefan?
To your point about changing the data, it's an interesting issue because there's this conversation in parallel going on that we've had a few times on the show about, you know, using data that's collected through Fitbits or other bits of technology to suggest that a person was at the scene of a crime or you know, place them somehow somewhere and say, because it was recorded by this device, it has to be true. And then you can imagine, you know, you have your Apple iPhone in your pocket, you put it down, your friend picks up your iPhone by mistake and walks away with it, and then the geolocation data suggests that you were going down the street, and then there's a crime that happened somewhere near there, and all of a sudden you have to explain away that, well, hold on a second, that, you know, yeah, that's my phone, but I didn't have it with me, my friend had it. And you could get into this whole complex thing where it's your word against what's shown in the data. And so being able to change it sounds weird, but at the same time, I think it's good to probe whether these recordings are actually quite so immutable and reliable. Mm-hmm. And having that conversation about when does personal testimony and other evidence trump what the technology that's tracking us says, having a framework for that discussion and having an ability to remind people that technology is not in fact immutable is a good and healthy instinct, I think, to follow through with tools like what Apple's provided here.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And if you're wondering why you might want to change inaccurate data, I think Stefan just nailed it right on the head for you, that at some point in your life, that data could become very relevant to some sort of consequence you might face or goal you might be trying to achieve where the you need to come forward with that data. All right, so on that note, manipulation of data and such, let's move on to the social web. Let's start out with something that might get you sued that you might not realize could get you sued. Very interesting story by Ashley Collins at The Hollywood Reporter, reporting on a couple of different instances of folks who have retweeted things that they've seen on Twitter and ended up in legal hot water just for the retweet. And because of the inaccuracy of the thing that was retweeted. So we're in the realm of defamation law here. And the recent example involved MSNBC host Joy Reid. An activist, Alan Vargas, tweeted a photo of a woman in a MAGA hat who was seemingly yelling at a high school student during a city council meeting in Simi Valley, California. The woman was apparently in that crowd, and reportedly folks in the crowd were said to have called the student terrible things and made racial slurs against the student. And the MSNBC reporter retweeted a photo of this woman where the woman was attributed with those statements. And she said, spread this far and wide, wanting to call out the horrific nature of the statements and make people aware of them. Well, it turns out that the woman didn't actually say what she was attributed to have said. So there was subsequent news coverage that corrected things. The reporter apologized, but the woman whose last name is, her full name is Roslyn La Liberté, has now sued the MSNBC host Joy Reid for defamation for, simply by retweeting this. For what that would be under defamation law is a republication. And because of her reach on Twitter, she could have some significant liability in this issue. And that, for everyone who has on their bio the tagline, retweets are not endorsements or something like that, thinking that that may protect you, you need to dig a little bit more deeply into defamation law as this lawsuit demonstrates. There's also some discussion here about another instance involving James Woods, involving a retweet as well. Stefan, what do you think about retweet defamation liability?
this again seems to be one of those areas where the U.S. system is pretty good at generating, attempting to address policy sort of metaphorically anyway at gunpoint. So to have a lawsuit that has these facts underpinning it and trying to then negotiate a good result while facing liability for something like this just seems like a very uncivilized way to get to a good result to me. And I don't blame Ms. La Liberté for being upset about having been tagged with this label and understand she has recourse. I don't know if this is going to be an optimal result if you open up the Florida lawsuits for retweets. I mean, it just seems like it could have a real chilling effect. And so I hard for me to see this leading to sound policy, frankly.
Yeah, and I think everyone sort of intuitively feels that way. But the reason we're talking about it is because defamation law doesn't, you know, it developed long before Twitter was ever around. And it has this notion of republication that may need to be revisited, reexamined by the courts, reinterpreted by the courts, so that those two things come into convergence with each other. What do you think, Irene?
So the article says, you know, it's vital to think before you retweet, but now there's a new feature on Twitter that shows what people you follow like. So even if you like something, you know, it gets republished on other people's Twitter feed. So at this point, you know, people can be sued under defamation for retweeting something and that counts as republication. What about liking something? And then if people are hesitant to retweet and to like, where's Twitter now? What are the forms of interaction that are acceptable to protect people from being able to retweet or like something without, you know, recourse of being sued for defamation?
Right. And it would matter. I mentioned the fact that this person who's a defendant here is the host of a cable news show. That could very well play into the analysis as well, you know, just depending on what your reach and sphere of influence is. And there's a lot of discussion here about the context of the republication as well and how Twitter doesn't give much of an opportunity to provide a lot of context because it doesn't give you much of an opportunity to provide a lot of text. So I just think it's a fascinating development, and your point about likes possibly being a trigger for liability as well is very well taken. And again, I think that just doesn't jibe with how people think things should work, but it may be the way the law works until courts come in and start interpreting these cases differently, taking into account that the social media use case is different from maybe how the cases developed in early days when the only way that you could republish something is if you were a major publisher of some kind and had the means to put out a misstatement in a newspaper, say. Stefan, any final thoughts?
I wish I could zoom ahead like 10 years and see where this would lead, because right now it feels like we're you know, trying to plant a city 3 years after cars first started becoming popular, and we're trying to decide our city's going to be for pedestrians or for cars, and we haven't really made that fundamental design choice yet about how do we introduce this new and obviously very powerful technology into our lives. Obviously, with the car, we ended up with this like cities built with parking forward architecture and giant highways running through everything, and it seems that the car is one. I wonder who's going to win in 10 years, whether we're going to simply rearrange our lives around the demands of algorithms or whether we're going to say that the algorithms need to be subservient to human demands. I think there's this funny, I don't think people are really thinking about it in those terms, but I think they should be, that this is essentially a technology that has the power to completely reorient how human beings interact with each other. And right now we're using it to sort of augment interactions that are happening in real life. 10 years from now, the technology might be powerful enough that it kind of just takes over. And the choices we make about the architecture and how that technology is going to fit in our lives is going to be a big driver of how societies come together and how communities are formed. And there's this sort of, we're kind of like in a Houston right now. There's no zoning. Everything is just kind of a big mess. And I wonder if it's going to stay Houston or if we're going to become something a little bit more organized. And I just kind of wish I could go ahead 10 years from now and see what it all looks like and make that prediction now so that people then go back and cite me as having been really prescient. But I'm not able to do that, unfortunately.
Yep, we certainly hope so. All right. Well, speaking of being prescient, one thing that a piece at The New Yorker by Joshua Rothman, I think, is prescient about is that we're looking, he writes, in the coming years as technology advances, we'll have good reason to grow more skeptical about the videos we see. At the same time, we'll struggle to make use of that skepticism. And what he is talking about is this video of Jim Acosta at the White House press conference. Was it 2 days ago now? Has it only been 2 days since this happened? Where Jim Acosta was having an altercation with President Trump and had a microphone removed by a White House intern, a young woman White House intern. And various video of this has come forward. And the question is, has the video been altered or faked in some way? The controversy is, if you look at some versions of the video, it appears that Jim Acosta is simply trying to hold on to the microphone and brushes the woman's hand aside when she reaches for it. And in a different version of the video, which was showcased, speaking of people with reach, by the White House press secretary, it makes it appear that perhaps he's moving more quickly, or, you know, his arm movement is more aggressive. He's borderline striking her arm. And Sarah Sanders yesterday came out and said, oh, we're not going to tolerate this kind of behavior by the White House press corps. So when you get into the weeds on this thing, which a lot of tech journalists have done, they've gotten to the original video source, which appears to have been an animated GIF image from the Twitter account of the Daily Wire. Then there was a person who works at InfoWars, Paul Joseph Watson, a contributor there, who took the GIF and either transcoded it or simply converted it out of GIF format. This is what he's told journalists who've asked him. He says, I didn't do anything to it. I didn't slow it down, speed it up, or blur the video. I simply converted it out of GIF format, and that now we have this different looking video. And this is what the White House decided to showcase, or Sarah Huckabee Sanders on behalf of the White House decided to showcase. And then the other little wrinkle to this is that Sarah Sanders didn't give an attribution or say where the video had come from, and appears to have taken some steps. Let me get to exactly what she did to it. Appears to have taken some steps to actually affirmatively obscure where the video came from. And I'm missing the part of the article, but I'll find it in a second and clarify that. So the bottom line here is that we don't even, and this is the point of this New Yorker piece by Joshua Rothman. We've talked a lot about the show, about deep fakes on the show, but he points out that this isn't even a very sophisticated altering of the video. It's just enough to sort of add confusion and let people believe what they want to believe about what happened here, which is really kind of terrifying. Stefan, what do you think?
So this goes back a few weeks ago, we talked about deep fakes, and I think I tried to make the point that I'm more concerned about not the really truly sort of well executed deep fakes, but just that very crude ability to insert doubt. And I think this really goes to that point. It's really, I mean, take a step back for a second and tell somebody, imagine somebody telling you 4 years ago that this is the conversation you'd be having about something coming out of the White House, somebody manipulating a GIF to make it look like a journalist hit an aide. I mean, it is beyond depressing that we're even talking about this. But seeing as we are, I think this really underscores how little sophistication is required to create a big mess, and people will just believe it. And I don't even really know what to say beyond the fact that this is really a disgraceful turn in a really depressing story.
It is. And just to clarify what went on here and what I was alluding to before, what's reported here in The New Yorker is that when Sarah Huckabee Sanders tweeted out the video that made it look more aggressive, instead of retweeting Watson, the guy from InfoWars, Sanders or someone handling her Twitter feed had downloaded and re-uploaded the video, obscuring its source. So one could say maybe they just didn't want to retweet InfoWars. But again, I mean, I guess we could get into the copyright ramifications of all of this too. Some news agency took this video, and of course we could talk about what it means to attribute or not attribute or freely share around video that you did not take. Irene, what do you make of this morass?
I saw a lot of people tweeting George Orwell's 1984 quotes when this was going around. And when I saw the video myself compared to what was tweeted by Sarah Huckabee Sanders, it was just scary because there's definitely a handful of people who wouldn't go elsewhere to look for, you know, another source of the video or to clarify what happened. It's really scary in a time now in politics where we can't trust, you know, our government to be a source of truth.
Yeah. And it's really scary. I mean, I get back to this notion that we're not only, I think in a deep fake scenario, you could at least sort of get to the bottom of, you know, whether a photo or a video was altered. Forensically, there are tools, or there will be tools, you know, as the cat and mouse of what you can do and then how you can determine whether things have been manipulated continues to go on. But if simply altering a video by changing its format can change the meaning of the video, you have to just kind of throw up your hands and go, we can't know what reality is, whose reality we're living in. And that's not a great, you know, I don't think, hold on, I'm blocking Clint. I don't think Clint much approves of that. that's my interpretation of my over the shoulder office mate here for the day. Any final thoughts, Stefan?
I encourage everyone to read Masha Gessen whenever topics like this come up. She's a great thinker and writer and has a lot of interesting things to say about the current moment. So look her up. She's wonderful.
All right. Spell that, please. I'm not familiar with.
M-A-S-H-A, Masha. Mm-hmm. Last name Gessen, mm-hmm. G-E-S-S-E-N. She writes for The New Yorker as well often.
Cool.
And she just actually 15 minutes ago posted about this story. And it's posted on The New Yorker about, less than 15 minutes ago. It's a very, very fresh take from Masha Gessen. Anyway, she's great. Look her up.
All right. Yes. Wonderful. I will indeed. And you all should too. All right. Since we're talking about deep fakes, let's go on and delve into the realm of artificial intelligence, robots, et cetera, et cetera. Where shall we start with this? Let's start with the AI and automation and data angle of all of this. We have a piece by ZDNet in the rundown this week that is entitled, "This is how artificial intelligence will become weaponized in future cyber attacks." So this seems like a good segue from our discussion of manipulated videos. Of course, we know that they can be weaponized to manipulate people's opinion. This piece is focused more on how AI intersects with conventional tools to hack and cyber attack, and how it will exponentially change how that occurs, make it easier, I assume, to be compromised and to compromise others. And one thing I found really interesting here, and seems to be a common development in the legal field, is there's mention of a law firm that fell victim to a phishing campaign here, leading to a TrickBot infection and the damage and devastation that ensued afterwards. And it's certainly not the first time, and I'm sure it's certainly not the last time, that the legal industry will be in the crosshairs for this. We manage a lot of sensitive data, much like the financial industry, and our denizens may not be the most tech savvy people in the world. So they might be more able to be compromised with a sophisticated spear phishing kind of attack. So Irene, this is kind of your area of expertise. Are you terrified by the convergence of artificial intelligence and cybersecurity threats, or no?
I think the most telling case is when I was about to graduate in 2017, you know, I had peers that were saying, well, this is all computer stuff and I don't need to worry about it because I'm not a computer person, as if, you know, using technology in the practice of law wasn't going to continue developing, or that these tools weren't continuing to be more sophisticated. So if, you know, my peers who are termed digital natives aren't knowledgeable about this kind of stuff, you know, it's really concerning that there are, you know, current seasoned professionals who may not be able to keep up with this stuff or don't know about the current state of these technologies. So it's definitely scary that there are people who might not know about this and might be, you know, sort of in the stand unwilling to learn about these kind of cyber attacks or how it can affect their practice.
Right. So you've been doing some tweeting and some writing lately about the American Bar Association's attempt to deal with this situation in the legal field. Tell us about Formal Opinion 483.
So in Formal Opinion 483, the lawyers, the ABA Formal Ethics Committee gave a formal opinion about a lawyer's obligation after an electronic data breach or cyber attack. And specifically, it focuses on when a breach involves client information. So a basic rundown of this is that attorneys must avoid a data breach by staying technologically competent, reasonably safeguarding client information, and then also ensuring compliance of other attorneys, staff, and vendors who are involved in client information. And when a breach does happen, one important thing to note is that there's no safe harbor in communicating that your firm has been breached to clients. What that means is that regardless of the safeguards that you might have had in place, there is a duty to communicate with current and former clients of the extent of the breach, any mitigation risk, as well as ongoing developments in the breach.
Okay, and do you think that this is going to be effective in dealing with this problem in the legal industry, and a model maybe for other industries?
I think the legal industry, I think this opinion is a long time coming, but I definitely don't think that this is going to be the end all be all. I think what this does, it places an ethical duty, but I think the compliance mechanisms that are put in place by current statutes and federal regulations are definitely a lot stronger and more explicit of what, you know, someone holding client information needs to have, regardless of whether or not it's within the legal context.
Yep. And we'll look a little further on in the show to some proposed legislation at the federal level, you know, that would be cutting across various industries on how they're going to do a better job of protecting data. One thing that Joshua Browder, who's been on our show before, would like everyone to do a better job of is giving access to justice in situations where, as we've been discussing throughout the show, perhaps people might not have the resources to either fight a lawsuit or to pursue rights and remedies that they have available to them just because the legal process is so expensive. Joshua Browder is a guy who started the Do Not Pay app. And as I said, we had him as a guest on the show. I'm not sure exactly which episode it was. It was some time ago now, maybe more than a year ago now. But he has been busy in that time because the Do Not Pay app, which was designed to fight parking tickets, is just one of the many projects that Josh is involved in now. And he has just released a whole bunch of tools that help people do all manner of things in the legal system. They are bots that are machine learning assisted, and they take people through various scenarios and make analyses that help them represent themselves in court. One of his more interesting recent tools is the ability to initiate a small claims action in any small claims court anywhere in the United States. So if you have some dispute that you otherwise would feel over your head about bringing and don't feel competent to represent yourself without a little bit of help in small claims court, this new bot covers all the courts in all 3,000 counties in all 50 states. So that would certainly be helpful. There are a whole slew of other things that are available along these lines. They help people fight bank, credit card, and overdraft fees. Again, the parking tickets thing was sort of, I think, the origins of his endeavors along these lines. Claim settlement money from governments or class action suits. Earn refunds from Uber and Lyft when a driver takes a wrong turn. Fix errors on your credit report. All kinds of other things that they're trying to basically botify here to help all have access to legal remedies that they might not otherwise think about pursuing. Irene, what do you make of this?
Well, I want to first say, don't let perfect be the enemy of good, but mm-hmm. I do wish this tool was more defined, as I think it takes a one-size-fits-all approach. I'd really like to see sort of more of a triaging system where if someone's problem is more complicated or beyond the scope of the tool, that, you know, the tool will say, hey, it's time for you to consult an actual attorney, or something that says, like, we can't handle this complicated of an issue. For example, I did download the tool and I've been playing with it. One of my favorite parts is the maximizing privacy settings function, where you can go on your Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram and apply the maximum amount of privacy settings allowable. But I think it's sort of unrealistic to expect everyone to be a privacy vegan, and that's not always necessary. So I think that there's definitely some refining to do with this tool, but I think it's a good first step. I just think that, you know, sometimes we should really focus on the quality rather than the ambition of a tool, which is something that Nicole Braddock of Theory and Principle pointed out when the tool initially came out.
Yeah, I think those are both great points. Stefan, what do you think? Do you think that something like this should be out in the wild, even if it's not perfect? And do you think it should be more sophisticated, or do you think the only way it gets that way is if more and more people use it?
Probably the latter. This is one of those beta situations, or essentially there's beta testing being done by the general public. Mm-hmm. I'm a little concerned that this is sort of ripe for abuse. I mean, you could easily see this just becoming a tool of harassment for people who, write some script that can just initiate lawsuits against people to harass them. There's not a clear path that I see that takes a concept like access to justice and uses an app to operationalize it. I think over time we might get there, and there's going to be mistakes made along the way, and maybe it will have been worth it. I do worry that this is something that could easily be abused, and I don't know that the rhetoric around access to justice is really the right description for this. I think it certainly reduces the cost, which is good. We'll see where it goes. I don't know that... I think, as Irene pointed out, of sort of a one-size-fits-all approach is really the best one here. I'm a little nervous about it. It's not because I'm an attorney. I mean, the cynical view is, of course, I would say that because I'm an attorney and I don't want technology threatening my livelihood. But that's not quite, I think that's a cynical response here. I think really what this is about is the potential for abuse is just a little too high for me to be totally comfortable with it.
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking about copyright trolling a lot on this episode. I'm a little bit concerned about the whole bots on top of bots issue, that if somebody turned an AI loose on some of these apps and said, you know, find every instance where I could sue someone for this kind of problem and then go out and do it, it could be used that way. It could be used to... harass and intimidate. At the same time, the world where, you know, my legal interest bot is chatting with some other legal interest bot and making sure that the world is an equitable place seems pretty wildly utopian. So I'm with you, Stefan. I think this is early days for this kind of technology, and we'll have to wait and see if it's how it's used for good and ill. But it's certainly interesting that it's out there. Yeah, go on.
So I just sent a link on the chat here that people who are on the chat will be able to access. I think it is the best metaphor that I have seen for any of these technologies. It's a few years old now, but it stays relevant, and I kind of rewatch it every few months because it just sort of provides some weird comfort. It's called Dueling Carls. I don't know if anybody's ever seen it, but it's essentially someone took two smartphones, and there's an app on the smartphone that mimics your voice and kind of says it at a higher pitch. So, you know, repeats whatever you said with a higher pitch. Someone then took two of these apps and on two phones and ran them against each other. Yes, there it is. You know, you could even just play it. It only takes a few seconds if you're interested.
He's going to get in a fight. My voice is higher than your voice.
My voice is higher than your voice. My voice is higher than your voice.
So the point
at some point it only becomes discernible to dogs.
I guess so. But the point is, this is an example of what happens when you sort of loose the bots on the bots. And at some point, you know, that's obviously a very trivial example. It's just a funny little gag. But you could imagine mm-hmm. that happening with all sorts of ramifications if you are relying on this technology for something other than a sight gag. And I think that's my concern with these kind of apps that allow you to just launch lawsuits very simply. It's not necessarily something you want to be very easy. I was thinking the other day, it's like, right now you can call a car through Uber. Everybody's used to that idea. What if you had private security forces, essentially loosely formed militias that you could summon with an app, and everybody showed up at your house because they thought, you were in distress at the push of a button, and all of a sudden a bunch of law-abiding citizens with concealed carry permits show up at your house. That's something that we could do within the current legal framework pretty easily, and the technology's there. We could create that system, but would we want it? And I think just watch that video the next time you think the optimal social solution is to just make something easy, because it's not. When you lose control of it, it scrambles the whole message, and that's I still think that's a very fair thing to worry about. In the context of making it easy to file lawsuits.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, and one that I hope that social media providers are listening to as they listen along with our show. I think we'll put our first MCLE passphrase into the show. We put these phrases in case you are watching or listening for professional credit in your field, including perhaps the legal field. We have a page of resources for lawyers in the U.S. That's at twit.to/MCLE, which talks about various jurisdictions and how you might go about applying for credit in different ones and whether you should even bother in other ones. Anyway, we put these phrases in because some places like to know, guess what, that you actually watched or listened to the show. So our first phrase for this episode of This Week in Law will be privacy vegan, which I love. Irene, did you just coin that on the spot, or is that something in common parlance that I just haven't heard before?
No, I actually got it from the director of cybersecurity at EFF. I saw her tweet about it once, and I love the phrase because I think, it's a little unrealistic for people, even people who are privacy advocates, to be privacy vegans.
Right. It's awesome. All right. So that's our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of the show. And we will move on now. And I teased that there is perhaps some light at the end of the tunnel. I think the tunnel is still long, though, for federal data protection legislation. Let's look at where things stand now. First off, Intel has done something fairly interesting. It's drafting its own data privacy bill, which is not something that I think of private companies doing much of, but it is trying its hand at putting together a data privacy bill for the federal government to enact. And it has already published its 6,000-word draft of the bill, and it wants public comments from privacy experts and hopefully some privacy vegans too, and also consumers. And it's casting about for a congressperson to sponsor the bill. So fascinating development there. And if you are interested in and think that Intel might actually have the horse that might win this race, you might want to weigh in and give your public comment during the time that it's taking it. Irene, what do you think about this?
Well, speaking of horses, I think this is really Intel trying to make sure that it doesn't get these horse and whatever vision does go around AI, that it doesn't stifle innovation. Because I think a lot of the technology legislation that comes through is really stifling. And it's because, the technology companies and people that actually understand how these things are developed don't have a hand in the legislation process. One thing I really liked about Intel's website is that there's both a public discussion and an expert discussion page. And I would be interested in delving more into that once it gets, more developed and gathers a lot more comments.
Right. And I that's a good point to mention, too, that, of course, many states are trying to develop their own data privacy laws, which could be wonderful models for the federal government, perhaps, but maybe as in perhaps, for example, the California law, might not be what exactly companies like Intel and other tech companies want to see implemented. Maybe it's not too surprising that you see them getting into the mix too and hoping that the federal government will do something that's a little bit more friendly to them, in addition to providing some unity to the laws in this area in the United States. One person who has a different approach for the federal government is Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon, who has announced a draft, a discussion draft of his Consumer Data Protection Act. This has been out for a little over a week now, and its hallmark is hefty fines against executives, not just against the companies, but against the individual executives of those companies for breaches of this bill. So sort of the scuttlebutt about this one is that, and the reason I said the tunnel is still long, is I don't think this much has much chance of being adopted in its present form, but maybe it's a way of putting some things on the table that could be appropriate in such a bill and that may be able to be horse traded out to get to a bill that is a little bit more, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, conservative, less harsh in its penalties, and yet a step in the right direction for requiring the data to actually be secured and protected. Now, there's nothing like harsh penalties to make sure that happens. So maybe Ron Wyden is onto something here. Stefan, what do you think?
The idea that anyone's going to be going to jail for this seems pretty outlandish to me. And if they do put that into practice, then I would worry about being like the second or third down the totem pole, like not the person actually making the decisions, but the fall guy who's going to actually go to jail. And it just doesn't seem like the right approach. But it's certainly a way to get people's attention and get them paying, get them to the table to negotiate for a more reasonable and nonetheless harsh approach. Going back a couple of stories to the Intel bit about them writing their own legislation reminded me of the American Legislative Exchange Council, which I'm not sure if everyone's familiar with, but there's some great interviews on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, both about ALEC and sort of there's one with a representative of ALEC as well. And it's essentially this consortium that writes legislation and then pushes it through state legislatures. And it's usually with sort of a pay-to-play model where you can get invited to the table if you pay a certain amount of money, and a lot of corporations pass laws that way, kind of behind the scenes. It's interesting to see Intel just sort of skip the middleman and go straight to drafting its own legislation, inviting input from the public. I wonder if ALEC is feeling like their business model is under threat by this. In any case, it's one way to get the public's attention is to invite their commentary. And so in that respect, I think this is a better model than trying to do it behind closed doors.
Yeah, absolutely. And just so people know what Senator Wyden has put on the table in his bill, under the proposed law, and it's written up in more detail at Ars Technica by John Brodkin there, I believe. Yes. And then I just lost my place, of course, by checking his name. They could be executives of companies who violate the bill could be fined not more than $5 million or 25% of the largest amount of annual compensation the person received during the previous three-year period from the covered entity, prisoned not more than 20 years or both. So this is definitely putting the screws to the actual people in charge to make sure that things go the right way. And again, I mean, this kind of feels like something from a negotiation course. You know, let's start with our, let's start with Ron Wyden's dream scenario and then work to something maybe more acceptable and workable to others who don't share that dream scenario. So I feel like that might be what's going on here. Or maybe it just is so extreme in its penalties that some other bill, like maybe Intel's, comes in and does the job instead. But at least it's something that Congress seems to be paying attention to. And so look for more along those lines. And let's make our second MCLE passphrase for the show before we get into our concluding material here. Dueling Carls, based on the wonderful screeching box at each other that Stefan gave us earlier in the show. So we'll start off with our tips of the week. I have a couple of them for you. Number one, again, speaking of lawsuits that troll for copyright, et cetera, et cetera. There's actually an app for that, it turns out. If you are a person who uses image search on the web and finds pictures and reuses them and hasn't given much thought to that and hasn't paid attention to the fact that there are databases of licensed images that you can use, see Creative Commons, for example. Unfortunately, what a lot of people do is just simply go to an image search tool, find the image that they like, and then use it in their blog post or their article or whatever it is that they are doing for commercial purposes or otherwise. And what they don't realize is that that runs afoul of copyright law. Well, Pixie realizes this. It is a dedicated product that helps creators find where their images are being copied without permission. It is specifically targeted at this realm of people just copying and pasting things that they find randomly around on the internet. And what it does is it allows the it alerts you if your image has been used without your permission. And then you then, as the rights holder, can submit the infringing image for further action by Pixie. So you're basically outsourcing your legal action to Pixie. The site will then take care of the rest, and it will get paid if the artist gets paid too. What they say is, once submitted, our expert case managers handle everything from preparation to evidence collection, negotiation, settlements, and payouts. So this is sort of melding together the finding of the infringing image and then the whole process of pursuing that legally and presumably on a contingency basis with the app manufacturers getting paid if they actually prevail on the misuse of the image. And it's this sort of harkens back to the insurance triage we were talking about earlier, where they're looking at a realm where there is a lot of actionable copyright infringement going on that could be lucrative, but isn't being pursued because of the barriers to doing that. Well, it's eliminating some of those barriers. So the tip is twofold. First off, don't think that you can just reuse images that you find on the internet. We give you that tip all the time. And I suppose, secondly, if you are a rights holder, a photographer, someone interested in making sure that your images are used the way that you want them to be used, I guess check out Pixie, because it's sort of your one-stop shop for taking care of that problem if you have it. And then my second tip of the week has nothing to do with technology law, everything to do with technology convenience. I just think it's amazing that we have arrived at the point where you can order and have Prime delivered to yourself a live Christmas tree. And yes, you can order your Christmas tree this year off of Amazon Prime. They appear to be doing a partnership with Hallmark. They have several different trees that you can choose from. Some of them, I believe, are 7 to 10 feet tall. 6 to 7 feet tall seems to be as tall as they go. And prime yourself a tree. If people are postmating all their food, now they are now priming their trees as well. Our resources of the week are twofold. Number one, we've been talking a lot about data management and security on the show today, and I wanted to highlight the fact that if you are lucky enough to meritorious enough, because it is one of our illustrious and hard to get into universities in the United States. But if UC Berkeley is at all an option for you or anyone you know, they now offer a degree in data science, a Bachelor of Arts in Data Science. where they focus on such things as computational, statistical, and mathematical depth, including core data science courses designed from the ground up, breadth as reflected in the requirement for a domain emphasis, specializing in one of an array of subject areas, including inequalities in society, organizations and the economy, and then also there's a societal awareness piece to the major as well, an understanding of the social and human contexts in which data are applied and of related concerns such as privacy, governance, and the human impacts of a data-abundant society. So we have arrived at the point not only where you can have a tree prime delivered to your house, but where there is a major that is all about the application of data to our daily lives. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And then the other resource you might want to check out, one thing that we talked about on the show quite a bit while it was going on, was the Uber Waymo case that was litigated quite dramatically and ultimately settled. There is a piece at The New Yorker that was published on October 22nd by Charles Duhigg. And it is a detailed deep dive into that lawsuit with a lot of the anecdotes from the trial, a lot of the really sort of juicy details of what happened here. So if you are interested in learning more about that, I commend you to this New Yorker piece that's called Did Uber Steal Google's Intellectual Property? And with that, let's check out our animal selfie of the week. With the disclaimer that this is not actually a selfie, and so we don't really have any intellectual property to discuss. But we now know where everyone's favorite ringtone came from, with apologies to Keyboard Cat as well. Jonathan Annett submitted this, and it was too cute not to feature as our animal selfie of the week. I always wondered who was playing that xylophone, and now we know. So thank you, Jonathan, for that. And I think that's it for this episode of This Week in Law. We've had a lot of fun meeting you, Irene. It's been a wonderful discussion. I really appreciate your taking the time to jump in here with us and go deep on what you've been working on and on data privacy and security in general. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Irene, is there anything you would like to let people know about, either what you're working on or just anything you'd like to highlight or plug before we sign off for the day?
Nope. Follow me on Twitter or LinkedIn. I look forward to getting to know the community better.
Thanks so much, Irene, for joining us. We hope to have you back sometime soon on This Week in Law. And Stefan, it's been really great chatting with you too. Thanks for all of your input during the week as we got ready for the show.
Thank you. Glad we finally got to work the Dueling Carls into this show. I've been thinking about that for a while, so there's a great excuse today.
Yeah, Dueling Carls is awesome. Or not, actually. I like that you brought it up in the context of it's a fun little thing to consider at first blush, but when you spin out the ramifications, it might not be so fun at all. I don't want to hear those Carls shrieking at me in every aspect of my life. So thanks so much for everything today. There we go. Oh, here. And Beatmaster let me know that at the end of the show, in honor of Clint, I'm giving him an empty chair. Yay! Thanks so much, everyone, for joining us on This Week in Law. If you joined us on a Friday, then you know that you joined us at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. Oops, we just changed the clocks. I believe it's 1900 UTC this time of year. And that's when we record the show. Every Friday, we get together. Do this. You can watch with us live, warts and all, before the show is edited at all. If you like, jump into IRC. If you do that with us at irc.twit.tv is where you can play along live, heckle us during the show, et cetera, et cetera. We love having a live audience, but if you can't do that, don't worry about it. Head on over to twit.tv/twill, and our entire archive of shows is there for your perusal. dive in, find Joshua Browder's show there. That was a good one. We also had, oh gosh, who's the Ross Intelligence guy? Is he another Josh? He was on that same show. Andrew Arruda, yes, exactly, was on that same show. So that's a good one to dive into the archives and find and dredge up for yourself. Or just subscribe and listen to the shows as they come out. Please do however you consume the show. And there are lots of ideas on our show page for how that might happen best for you. We love your feedback. Either email me, I'm Denise at twit.tv. You can also just generally email the show, twill@twit.tv. Let us know what's on your mind, what you thought about what we discussed today. If you have any thoughts or suggestions or follow-ups that you want to give us, suggestions for guests are always quite welcome. So definitely let us know, give us a shout. And whatever platform you do use to consume the show, if there's some way of giving us feedback there, if you can give us ratings or comments or whatever, we always appreciate that too. And you've got our Twitter handles. Those have been up throughout the show. I'm D Howell at Twitter. And Stefan is Stefan Spida, his entire name with no spaces. And Irene is Irene Mo KX on Twitter if you want to follow her there. Great ways to keep up with us as we go about the rest of our lives here after this episode of This Week in Law. We hope that the rest of your lives are productive and wonderful and happy and as data vegan as you want to make them. We will see you next week on This Week in Law. Until then, please take care.